Thanks for listening to the podcast. Stay connected on Facebook/ IFBB Ben PAK fan page, on Twitter at IFBB Ben PAK, and of course, BenPokulski.com.
Okay, what's up, ladies and gents? Ben Pokulski coming at you with John Meadows, podcast number one, man. We're really excited. We've got an amazing, amazing guest for you today, someone that I'm incredibly excited to have and to be able to speak with, Mr. Brad Schoenfeld. Brad, welcome.
It's my pleasure, man.
And Mr. Meadows, how's your day going, sir?
Oh, pretty good. I don't think I've beat my personal pancake best of 7 that we hit out in Vegas. I think I've only got 4 or 5 down for this morning, but things are good.
Well, when I get out there to Columbus and we smash some legs, we'll be breaking some new records, I think. Since then, both of us are feeling better, and you know, we can definitely up the pancake quota. So yeah, for those of you that don't know Brad, you should, and you should probably research him, because he's one of the people that I view as one of my authorities. One of the guys that anytime he puts anything out in news articles, I research it, I read it, because Brad's one of the guys who's not only doing the research, but he's also in the trenches, and you know, as an aspiring bodybuilder and an aspiring physique athlete and guy who just is an all-around badass. So Brad, again, thanks so much for joining us, and why don't you take a second to tell people about who you are and why you're a badass.
Yeah, sure, man. First of all, I'm not sure I'm quite a badass like you, but I think what really makes me unique, one of the things that makes me unique, is that I have, as you mentioned, this practical experience. I've been a bodybuilder, competed in numerous natural bodybuilding shows over the years, and trained many, many physique competitors, both the professional and the high-level amateur level. Over the years, I owned my own facility for almost 20 years, sold it a couple years ago. So I have a lot of in-the-trenches experience, as well as the fact that I'm a researcher and educator. I'm currently a lecturer at Lehman College in the Bronx in the exercise science program. I've published over 40 peer-reviewed articles. I've also been a columnist for many of the magazines. I've been Fitness RX. I've been published in Muscle and Fitness and Muscle Mag and pretty much every muscle rag you can think of over the years. And ultimately what I'm about is taking the grow science out of exercise science and then translating it into optimizing muscle. My primary interest is in muscle development. So I'm carrying out research. And one of the things I do is that I like to look at, based upon my practical experience, look at what I've done and say, hey, I've noticed this through my training and through training others. Does this actually have a research basis? Because we know that what we go through anecdotally, as you know, individually, might not actually translate over the course of many people. Could that be just something I'm noticing for whatever reason that really doesn't translate? So, anyway, I think it's a cool balance, and certainly my I think the most important aspect that I can give is that I'm a research geek who actually is in the trenches.
I mean, John, I'm sure you'll agree. I think that's kind of what we all are, is, you know, the three of us anyways, is deep down we're probably geeks who just want to, you know, live it out in a Superman's body.
Yeah, you know, from my perspective, there's two things going on here. And I love what Brad is saying, because he's not dismissing the practical side of it. And, you know, everything that is sort of proven, you know, at one time it was a theory, and this is what I love about Brad, is he's not afraid to theorize and say, well, maybe it could be this, could be that. You know, we're going to try to figure out why these things are happening. So, you know, that's pretty cool. And I think it's pretty rare, too. You know, the other thing is, for guys like you and me, Ben, and many of the people out there, we just, you know, we don't have access to research facilities, and we don't see the kind of research is going on. So like you, I look to Brad to find out what's going on. You know, it's funny, Brad, a couple hours ago, our mailman showed up, and in my mail, I had a new strength and conditioning journal, and I opened it. There's actually two of them. There's the research one and the other one. And the first two articles I see are articles by Brad. So you know, I always kind of skim it, and I try to figure out who wrote what. And when I see stuff from Brad, that's a, hey, don't shred this one. Don't throw it away. Read this article. So now to my left, I have two journal articles here to read. Brad, one of them was the one you did on rear delt activation and hand grips. And the other one was it was around soreness and is it valid or not. So really cool stuff having people like Brad around.
Thank you, bro.
You know what? Actually, I'm interested in that topic right there is the validity of soreness, Brad. If you want to dive into a little bit of that in a few minutes about what you found in your research.
Sure.
And is soreness really an indication of growth or is it even necessary for growth?
Yeah, it's actually a really interesting topic. I'll kind of give you the short course in that there is a correlation between soreness and muscle damage. So in that respect, as a general rule, overall soreness can be indicative of muscle damage, and there is certainly some evidence that muscle damage can help to drive a hypertrophic response. There are various factors, including what are called myokine release, which are substances that the muscle themselves produce that are involved in growth, and various other factors. So on the surface, you'd say, well, sure, that soreness is indicative of muscle growth. However, if you actually look at the research, soreness is only a general indication. Number one, there's other factors that can be going on. There's actually greater evidence that the soreness, while it correlates with muscle damage, it actually is more related to connective tissue issues. And it's not really clear exactly where that's coming from. But more importantly, many people, due to the repeated bout effect, which means that the more you train, the less the response to soreness. Basically, soreness happens because the body, the nerves get sensitized from the damage that's done, and there's going to be things that interact with the free nerves that causes pain. Well, over time, the body subsides its pain response, and that doesn't mean necessarily that you're not developing. So bottom line here, to make a long story short, is that soreness can be a general indication that you've worked a muscle in a novel way, which certainly can be a good thing. But just because you're not sore does not mean you didn't have a good workout. And just because you're sore does not mean you did have a good workout. And actually, too much soreness certainly is detrimental because if you're too sore, you can't train effectively, which is never a good thing. So that's really the short course, that it's overused as a tool. Doesn't mean there isn't something to be said that there is a general issue that if you have some degree of soreness, it says that you've stimulated the muscle in a novel way, but it really shouldn't be used as your overall gauge of whether you had an effective workout or not.
And I agree with that 100% because I know for myself, the more often I train, my best results come when I'm training each body part twice a week. And I don't really get that sore. I know I grow like a weed. As long as my nutrition is on point and my sleep is on point, I grow like a weed and my soreness is minimal. It's all about getting that cell volumization during the workout. Like I really notice from workout to workout, I can actually see growth. You know, whereas if I'm only training four times a week, like I have been for the last 6 weeks or so, I get extremely sore and it just doesn't seem like I grow.
Ben, it's a great point. And one thing that certainly also is shown is that there's a large individual response that some people, soreness is specific to the individual. So you can have basically the same amount of damage and different people will have different responses to it based upon various genetic factors, nutritional factors. So yeah, that's you make an excellent point. And that's certainly consistent with the research.
Would that just mean basically that someone is recovering faster or they just respond differently to the stimulus?
It's hard to know through the research, but probably that they're just responding differently. There are things called nociceptors that are pain receptors, and some people just can have more sensitivity than others in terms of how that responds. Now, could a greater recovery be a factor too? It's possible. It really, from what I've seen, the research isn't really clear on that.
Any thoughts on that, John? Any questions?
Yeah, you know, this one, I tell you, man, I did a 180 on this one a couple of years ago. I was one of the guys at the front of the line that was saying you have to get sore, you have to really just break the muscle down like you've never broken down before. And I did pretty well. I mean, I made it to the national level and I grew. But, you know, if I'm honest with myself, I look back at statistically, you know, kind of how much I weigh and body composition, I probably went 5 to 7 years and really didn't put on more than a pound or two of muscle once I got to a certain level. And, you know, I did some things with my training, nutrition, specifically around training, that completely changes for me. And I really eliminated soreness. And all of a sudden, you know, over the course of 2 years, I gained probably 11 to 12 pounds of dry stage weight. And I, you know, it definitely opened my eyes. And I wasn't getting sore at all. I mean, to the point, Ben and Brad, where I was thinking, man, am I not training hard enough? I mean, how much harder can I really train? And I grew. So it's, you know, it's one of these things. In the last couple of years, I'm with you guys. I mean, I would use 2 years ago, if you would ask me, I would have said, you're silly. You have to get really sore. But I was wrong. And that's the beauty of what Brad's doing. And you know, people like me can get corrected and we can figure out there's a better way of doing things. So I kind of accidentally discovered it with intra-workout nutrition, but really, you know, really sometimes you just got to back off and be honest with yourself and open your mind and your views will change.
Yep. Agreed.
And it sounds kind of funny, man, that, you know, you and I at the level we're at, John, is like, we're just kind of, I mean, personally, I'm just really discovering inner workout nutrition in the last couple of years. As much as it sounds ridiculous, I mean, I always kind of took something in, but I never really had any basis of science behind it. I was like, oh, maybe I'll take some carbs this workout, and there's never really any regard to BCAAs or anything like that. And now, I mean, I wouldn't go in the gym without taking BCAAs during the workout. And, you know, oftentimes, depending on what type of workout I'm after, oftentimes just carbs during the workout as well. So, I mean, you know, people see me as being someone who's a little more advanced than most people, and really I've only started doing that in the last year and a half to 2 years. So you can imagine where we'd be if we had actually known this stuff 10, 15 years ago.
Oh, and yeah. I'll say that I'm sorry, I was going to say the really great bodybuilders like you guys are constantly evolving, that they're not married to any concept and that they're constantly becoming more in tune with their bodies and with the research and melding them to promote a better response.
Well, and not only that, Brad, we want to learn a better way to do things. I mean, you know, I have in my mind some things that I think work now, but if you show me a better way to do it, then hell yeah, show me and let's get better. You know, that's kind of what I think people's mindset should be is, you know, you're going to learn things along the way, and but keep your mind open and get better and better. I really hope that 10 years from now, Ben and I are sitting here and, you know, we're talking about how, you know, in 2014 and 15, we had these awesome years of growth because we discovered some new ideas.
Well, I'm thinking that in 10 years, both of you guys are going to be 300 pounds and 5% body fat. So that's what I'm going to be waiting for.
Well, I'm a midget, so that's going to be a pretty, you know, I'm going to occupy a lot of space if that happens.
Amazing. So, Brad, something I want to dive into, man, is everyone kind of wants to get to know you and some of the things that you have to offer, because I know there's a lot of questions I get all the time, so I want you to dive into some of those questions, and you can do it in like, you know, five or ten words or less.
Sure.
Some really simple stuff. Where were you born?
New York City, born and bred, never left.
Can hear it by the accent. Strangest place you've ever visited?
Probably the Amish country. It was kind of like being back in the 1800s. Definitely interesting, but strange to say the least.
Awesome. Favorite growth meal?
Pizza.
Favorite meal, yeah.
I'm not sure what kind of growth that is, but certainly my favorite meal, and it will make you grow.
And the strangest food you've ever eaten?
Probably an ex-girlfriend from Argentina took me to an Argentinian restaurant, and some of the meats they served were from parts of the animal that I never want to think about again. So.
Amazing. Okay, favorite book, and this could be obviously training related or not.
I would say Super Training by one of my mentors, Mel Siff, the late great
Mine
Mel
too.
Siff. So it's taken far too early, but just a great book.
That book literally, that's kind of what I based everything around, and it's ridiculously hard to read, but you know, I try to read a little part of it every week just to kind of keep my brain fresh and keep me thinking. John,
and by the way, it's
book?
Still fresh. It's about 10 years old, and it's still fresh. So.
Yeah, it really is. John, what's your favorite book?
Well, man, I tell you, I got a library here beside me. Super Training is one of my favorites, too. I don't know if you guys know, you know, I used to be a chapter leader for the Weston Price Foundation, and there is a lady named Mary Enig. I used to read her work, and she has a book called Know Your Fats. And I remember, I bet I read that book 50 times. I just found that book fascinating, and it really, she was ahead of her time. You know, she's an older lady, but you know, back in the 90s and the 80s, she was telling people our views on fats was pretty backwards. And that's one of my favorite books.
Great. And Brad, what book are you reading right now?
I'm more of a journal reader. I read about 2 hours a day reading research journals. The last book I read was probably over a month or so ago by Zatziorski called The Biomechanics of Skeletal Muscle, which was a very, very heavy read, but quite a good book.
Man, that's why you're at the level you are now, because like that type of dedication just day in, day out. I mean, I wish I had time and to be able, I mean, you make time to do that, but I wish I had time to do that, because like that's my passion, man, learning about that stuff and finding the people from the most remote parts of the world who are, you know, advancing in the research. That's so intriguing to me.
Yep.
Favorite bodybuilder?
Oh, probably Frank Zane. In my opinion, he had the classic physique, classic lines, perfect symmetry, and also like me, he was an ectomorph, which made his physique somewhat more attainable for someone like myself, who really is a classic. I was a classic endomorph, classic 115-pound weakling when I started lifting. So,
yeah, John, who's yours?
Tom Platz, love the guy. Intense, very thoughtful. I went to a seminar of his when I was 14 years old. I might have even been 13, but he was very bright. He's talking about Golgi tendon organs and all this stuff, and I'm just sitting there thinking, man, this guy is a genius. And his level of intensity is something that I aspire to, and I've certainly borrowed many of the training techniques and incorporated them into my programs. And strangely enough, I have his card sitting right here, and I plan on calling him today, try to chat with him. So easily my favorite guy there was Tom Platz.
Great. Mine too. Definitely one of my tops. Brad, squats or deadlifts?
That's like asking peanut butter or chocolate. I mean, they're both both great exercises. I do both of them. I probably gravitate a little more to squats. One of the things with deadlifts, when you're doing a split routine, can make it harder to recover for upper body movements, even though squats, there's more dynamic upper body movement. So I would tend to gravitate more to squats for what I do with my goal as being maximal hypertrophy.
So I noticed something recently that you posted, obviously you posted a lot about squats and biomechanics of squats. You posted something recently for Reebok about knees traveling over your toes. Can you give us a little bit of insight on that research?
Yeah, sure. Basically, that's certainly one of my hobby horses is squatting kinematics and kinetics. The myth, because it is a myth that you should never let your knees travel past your toes, is just that. It's really not based on any science, and it's kind of foolish or kind of illogical to think that the minute that your knees go a micro inch, you know, over your toes, that all of a sudden bad things start to happen.
Magic line.
There is research showing that the further out, what's called tibial translation, anterior tibial translation, so the further out that your knees go past your toes does tend to put more stress at the knee joint. However, multiple studies have shown, number one, that the actual stress to the knees is very modest, far lower than what the knees can handle. And more importantly, when you try to restrict the knees from going past your toes, what generally happens is you change the kinematics, you change the form at the hip joint and at the spine that causes more pressure, not only stress, not only at the hip, but even more importantly on the lumbar region, which is a more fragile area, obviously, and it's putting a lot of shear at that point on the spine. So bottom line is you should just allow your body to self-select. Certainly you should try to sit back into the squat. It's not that you want to force your knees forward, but different body types are going to, you know, if you have longer legs, your knees are going to go further past your toes. So it's just what it is.
Definitely. John, anything particularly you want to ask Brad about his research? I know he's doing a ton of stuff currently. I've got a few questions I want to ask specifically, but I'll let you go first.
Well, I'm always obsessed with the pump, right? I mean, people debate it endlessly, and I think we have a pretty big study, which is bodybuilding for the last 60 or 70 years, that shows that a pump is valuable. So I'm always interested in Brad's perspective on, you know, what is it about the pump that makes it makes a muscle hypertrophy? You know, is it the cell swelling? I mean, I don't know. I just think it's a cool topic.
It is a great topic, John. And actually, we have, co-authored with my good friend Brett Contreras, an article on that very topic coming out in the Strength and Conditioning Journal within the next couple of issues. Not sure exactly when, but yeah, it's a fascinating topic. And to say what is it, I can only speculate based upon what the research is, because really, when you're looking at research, you can only, in something like this, you can't necessarily put a cause and effect or draw a cause and effect relationship from what we have. But yeah, as you mentioned, the evidence seems to point to the fact that the cell swelling, meaning that the hydration within the muscle, water getting within the muscle and the fibers, causes a stretch of the exterior portion, what's called the cytoskeleton, of the fiber itself. And what happens is by putting pressure on the membrane of the cell, it causes a survival mechanism. So I can equate it to like blowing up a balloon. If you keep blowing up a balloon past a certain point, that balloon is going to pop. And obviously your cells do not want to pop. They're going to do everything they can to reinforce themselves. So the theory is that when you swell the cell through getting this rush of water in, hyperemia, the cell responds by saying, hey, there's a threat to its integrity, and it's going to then increase protein synthesis, which is the basis for growth, and also decrease degradation, which is breakdown. And that's pretty much a bodybuilding home run. If you're going to increase protein synthesis, and decrease protein degradation, that's going to really maximize a muscle protein accretion. And it's been shown that cellular hydration does have that very effect of increasing synthesis and decreasing degradation. So bottom line is that engaging the pump or training for a pump certainly has benefit, or at least all the research would suggest that, and that should be part of anyone who's looking for muscle hypertrophy should incorporate at least some pump training into their routines.
Amazing. So now, Brad, since you're the expert on the topic, what would be the three things you would suggest, whether it be supplement or perhaps nutrition or anything really, that you can suggest, those three things that people can do to really optimize or maximize the pump?
Well, maximizing the pump. Now, creatine is certainly one of them. Creatine draws fluid into the cell. Now, a lot of times people have this misperception. They'll say, well, I took creatine and I blowed it up, and it just doesn't really makes sense, because creatine is an intracellular, causes intracellular swelling. It shouldn't have much effect, if any, on extracellular swelling. And by drawing fluid in, it acts as an osmolyte, meaning it attracts fluid. It certainly would help the pump and help it more on a long-term basis as well, not only immediately post-workout, but if you're creatine loading, it should help over time. So that's one. Number two, I would suggest not only using some moderate to higher reps, but also I talked with John Meadows and Shelby about this in a previous podcast, but using some blood flow restriction training. I've been now using this for a couple of years in my own training. And the way I integrate it is at the end of the workout, I usually do it on a single joint type move. So after I finish my multi-joint moves, like squats, say I did some squats and leg presses, on the extensions, I'll tie, you want to go most proximally to the limb. So let's say you're doing legs, you'll tie it right at the groin area, roughly a 2-inch. You don't want to have a wide cuff, so the actual tying should be roughly 2 inches. I use knee wraps, basic knee wraps, and do 3 or 4 sets at moderate to higher reps, roughly 15 reps, and it really jacks up your pump.
Amazing. So now, actually, I'm going to ask one question for both of you guys. John, actually, you could probably answer this first. Is there any? Do you ever use creatine pre-contest, like loading for the contest? And Brad, what would your opinion be on that?
You know what? As Brad was talking, I wrote a note here. Ask Brad about pre-contest on creatine. So I typically don't, as a rule, but you know, maybe I was making a mistake. What I usually do is have guys that are maybe on the thinner side use it to help them fill out, but I've been a little leery of using it with, you know, some of the body types that are more, you know, endomorphic. So, you know, maybe I should be a little more liberal with using it. I think what I'll do, unless Brad corrects me, I like to do practice runs with people 2 weeks out from a show to see how they react. So maybe I'll start putting that in with practice runs. When I have used it, what I did, Brad, was I simply did 3 days at 20 grams, 5 grams, 4 times a day, just because from what I've seen, that was a loading dose, and you could maintain it with 5 grams, but I just wanted to make sure it was loaded real good for 3 days. So I'm not sure if that is similar to how you would do it or if you would do it differently.
Yeah, I mean, you basically hit the highlight points there, John. Number one, people respond differently to different things. So I would never give a cookie cutter recommendation for that would say everyone should be doing this. I have not, for the most part, and I've used it with pros that I've trained as well as high-level amateurs, seen negative effects where they look puffy, if you will. And by the way, that's nothing. This is kind of an interesting thing when you talk about research. You can never do a research study saying, well, did these guys get puffy? I mean, it's a subjective measure that would be impossible to study. So these are things that guys like you and me, in terms of being in the trenches and actually training these people, would have to do a visual and say, hey, look, you're looking a little, that you're spilling over a little as far as your water goes. But I have not noticed that, and I've trained a lot of people with the majority of people. Now, some people do not, number one, don't respond to creatine. Well, that has to do with how full their creatine stores are. And one of the issues that you get with most bodybuilders is that they're usually high protein eaters and meat eaters, which is generally going to store a lot of creatine. So past a certain point, you don't get any additional benefit from it. If their creatine stores are saturated, saturating them more is not going to do anything. So and the last thing is, I agree completely that you always want to do a test run several weeks out, because you don't want to be at that competition and say, shit, I didn't realize that this was something I shouldn't have done, or that my body was going to respond this way.
Yeah, definitely. The reason I asked the question is it's actually something that I've done pretty much for the most part in my career. Every time I only do it when I'm actually in really good shape. I never do it when I'm in bad shape, because I figure if there's any chance of me holding water, I don't want to do it. But when I'm in really good shape, I usually don't take it for about 2 weeks leading up to the show, and then I use it for my load. And I find it only makes me better. It just seems to make things harder and drier. Like you say, it's just sucking all the nutrients into the cell, or sorry, all the water into the cell. But yeah, I've definitely used it probably since 2007, and you know, obviously love the effects, and I'm a huge fan of loading the creatine.
And by the way, what I have done, I mean, I'm a big believer, or when I say big believer, certainly for most people, in depleting and doing a deplete and then a load, so which is again going to help with water, basically get that last week you're really refine yourself. So I do a deplete generally if it's a Saturday comp, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. Then generally I recommend loading Wednesday and Thursday. And often what I'll do is, like you're talking about, Ben, is to not have the creatine, because it really doesn't matter in that last. It's not like you're really pushing anywhere with real heavy weights those last couple
right.
weeks. And then loading on when you actually load for the carbs, you also load along with it the creatine. and it helps, again, to draw more water in because the deplete, and you deplete, not only do you deplete with the carbs, but you also deplete the muscular glycogen by doing high rep exercises, total body exercises. And I've found that, generally speaking, that works real well. And then on Friday, you basically assess, is the person too flat or did they overcarb? And then generally that one day is enough to make adjustments. But you do need to do that several weeks in it, or usually well in advance. You're not going to do it several weeks. Usually I do that well in advance to get to know the person, and then once the competition comes, you can make better judgments.
Awesome. Any other questions for Brad offhand, John? You want me to run with it?
I could ask Brad stuff all day. keep on moving. Go ahead.
Brad, my biggest question for you is, I mean, I've always used you as my resource, particularly for understanding methods of hypertrophy. So any insights into, you know, how people can really take the methods of hypertrophy or the proposed methods of hypertrophy and apply it to their training as far as manipulating, intensity, as far as manipulating, periodization and like that, just really would you optimize training around methods of hypertrophy? I mean, obviously other than cell swelling, like we spoke about, can you just talk a little bit about what the methods of hypertrophy are and then how you may train for that?
Sure. Back in 2010, I published a paper, which is now kind of a landmark paper, which discussed broke it down into the three basic factors that are going to be involved in promoting hypertrophy, and they are mechanical tension, which is basically the load that is placed on the muscle through resistance training, so whatever load you're using, and there has been thoughts that a certain threshold of loading is necessary as a percentage of 1 RM, and there's been some challenges to that over the years. But regardless, we know that a certain amount of mechanical tension, if you don't lift weights, you're not gonna, everything else doesn't matter. So a certain amount of tension is completely necessary, and how much of it then is somewhat up for debate. Then there's metabolic stress, and that kind of goes along with the pump, but there's many other factors. Metabolic stress is the buildup of metabolites through exercise that is generally maximized in a moderate to higher repetition realm. So you're 6 to 12 to 15 plus reps, and that's going to be things like your lactic acid accumulation, so buildup of hydrogen ions, which are the acidic portion of lactic acid, as well as lactate itself, and other factors, and as well as cell swelling. By the way, lactate acts as an osmolite as well, so that draws water in, and that enhances the swelling effect. And myokines and other things are involved in the metabolic stress, and also muscle damage, which we touched on before. So there is certainly good evidence that too much damage is not good and that you do need some. How much is still in question, but that some is beneficial. My general approach is, number one, training in a spectrum of repetition ranges to help to optimize or to make sure that you are you're hitting all of these factors in an optimal way, because we don't know, research is still not clear as to which one is best, and what is most likely is that it will vary from individual to individual. A guy like you, Ben, might be different as a true mesomorph, as an ectomorphic person, and that an endomorphic person would. So these are things we don't know, but the bottom line is that some variety of all the rep ranges is essential. You talked about periodization, such an important point in my humble opinion. The research is still somewhat equivocal, but part of the reason is that there's just too many factors in periodization. And without question, we need the whole purpose of periodization is to keep results happening without overtraining, with it, or what we would call non-functional overreaching, because overtraining is that's more of an extreme aspect to non-functional overreaching. But when you have non-functional overreaching, you're going to regress in what you're doing. So that involves, number one, having structured deloading phases. So you want to train hard, but then you want to have periods of downtime. People who constantly are training balls to the wall 6 days a week ultimately end up overreached. And that will depend on person to person, too. So your training experience, your genetics, your nutritional factors, your gear, a lot of factors are going to enter into that. But there, no matter who you are, you're going to need some structured deloading. My general recommendation is 3 weeks hard, 1 week deload, but that can be 5 or 6 weeks hard and then 1 week deload, or even on the other way for people who tend to overtrain more, go less. So that's so important. I don't know what other questions, I mean, I can go on, and there's just so many factors, like using specialized training techniques are really beneficial to heighten, let's say, metabolic stress. Things like drop sets are another very effective technique that also, by the way, heighten the pump, as you mentioned before, and I could go on and on.
Now, one question that's really quick that kind of ties into what you just said there is, as far as periodization obviously being such an important thing, who would you say is the best in the world for designing periodization programs, if anybody?
You mean besides me?
I don't really know.
I don't have access. If you're asking like books, a great book that's written is by Tudor Bompa and Greg Half. They did a terrific job. It's called Periodization, and it's an excellent book that discusses some of the techniques that I use, and I've actually used from that book, adopted some of my programming through it. But it's not really geared towards bodybuilding. So if you're asking for my hypertrophy, that's more for sports performance, et cetera. I am not aware really of other people I just don't know. I haven't been privy to some of the things given by other hypertrophy.
I don't know anyone either. That's why I'm asking.
Yeah, I was going to say that's because no bodybuilders do it.
I
think bodybuilders tend to be, it's funny because I think there's this irrational fear of overtraining. And so people will schedule deloads and they really haven't even pushed their body hard enough to require a deload. That's one of my observations. And the other observation is they just don't take any at all. But, you know, to your point, Brad, I think it varies so much. I mean, I can, with the people that I work with, I've seen people that needed to slow down a little bit after 3 or 4 weeks. But on the other hand, I mean, I've seen guys like, I'll give you an example, Mark Dugdale. I've seen Mark go 24 weeks straight and not need a break. I mean, literally not take a day off. And the 24th week, he looks significantly better than the first week. So there's just so many variables. I think as a coach, you have to find out, you know, I always ask people, how's your strength? How's your pump? And if you start to see all these things decline, that's when you got to kind of say, okay, maybe we need to take a step back. But I always thought it was funny, if you're doing awesome, you're kicking butt, you're growing, you're getting stronger, why deload? You know, your body's in a groove. So I think people are either too quick to deload or they just don't do it at all. And probably the right answer is somewhere in between, depending on how you're doing.
Let me address, because you made such a great point, is that a lot of people who consider themselves training for hypertrophy really have no clue about what hard training is. And I'll give you, for instance, right now I'm finishing up my dissertation study, which is, it's going to be a real landmark study, but it's looking at well-trained subjects. So these people have 4 years of experience on average. So these are very well-trained. That's a well-trained individual. And we're putting them through they're being trained in these sessions. And these people are being trained like they've never worked before. So they're coming out toasted from these sessions. So, yeah, if the average person, it's true, they don't train hard enough to need to deload often. That overtraining is not the issue. But when someone is training in a way that really pushes them, in the way certainly that I would advocate, and I'm sure that you do, they're going to need a deload at some point, based upon my experience. Now, there might be an outlier like you're talking about. If Mark Dugdale can go 24 weeks without it, more power. And there's other factors that we mentioned before that are going to enter into it, not only genetics, but other things that people are doing that if you can read between the lines, that are going to mitigate that. But I've never seen anyone who can just train forever and balls to the wall 6 days a week and not ultimately become overtrained if they're really training hard.
Mark,
you know,
go ahead, man.
You, Ben, you'll get a kick out of this. So Dave Tate and I, one time we went 42 weeks hard without a break. Probably not the smartest thing in the world, because when we got done with that 42 weeks, we were toast, and I think we both needed like an entire month off. But good point bringing up the term outlier, because a lot of times that's what we do in bodybuilding too, is we take an outlier and we use that as our rule of thumb. You know, I've heard people say, well, this blood flow restriction training, I didn't see Ronnie Coleman use it. You know, well, who cares? You know, why would you use him as an example? You know,
other thing though that you have to take into account, John, is that just because, even if someone is still, you can say, well, they're still making progress, it doesn't mean that if you had of instituted deloading that it would have had any negative effect, and possibly that it would not have even had an even more. See, that's kind of the N=1 fallacy that people start running into, so that you look at someone, and that's one of the reasons that research is so beautiful, because you do controlled experiments, and basically you take one group that does one thing and another group that does another and compare them, because you don't know, ultimately, you don't know what would have happened if they actually had have done it. And I'm not saying you would have gotten better results, but we can't say.
Well, I've said this on many podcasts. You know, drug use clouds what you're really doing. People get a good response. You know, they're using anabolic hormones and they get a good response. So they say, they just assume, well, this is how you should train because I'm making gains. That doesn't mean they're making the best gains they could possibly make, though. And
right.
It really, and the same thing with nutrition, you know, guys can take certain chemicals and they can get leaner. And so they just say, well, I can eat, you know, blah, 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 so get leaner. Yeah, but it's skewed from chemicals. And, you know, Ben and I are obviously deep in the sport and, you know, we see this often. So it's really frustrating that just because somebody is making some progress doesn't mean it's optimal progress.
Exactly.
Yeah, and with reference to Mark being an outlier, I mean, one of my things, obviously, he's genetically blessed, but as far as bodybuilders go, I don't think there's very many people who take better care of their body on what I call the back end, as far as just optimizing their body as a whole and worrying about their nutrition, their supplementation, and, like, making sure he's always healthy. You know, and then maybe thereby he can go 24 weeks and not be injured and not be overtrained. And I'm probably one of the guys who's also the same, is I get my best results when I'm, like, training twice a day, for 6, 8 weeks, 10 weeks at a time, and never taking a day off. And then I take a week off, and I go back, and you kind of feel so sore, and you're so achy, it takes you another 3 weeks to get back to where you were. So, you know, Mark just takes such good care of himself. That may be the reason he's an outlier, because, I mean, John, how many bodybuilders do you know that take as good care of themselves as Mark does?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he has all kinds of things he's doing to take care of his body, and I can't tell you how much money I've sunk into various treatments, you know, something as basic as deep tissue massage every week to, you know, whatever. And recently, actually at your suggestion, Ben, I started doing MAT. Just had my first treatment done in a long time, a couple of days ago. And, you know, that's right. You know, if you have the money and you really want to stay in one piece and stay healthy, you can do it. You can. You know, give your body the ability to recover. It's just a matter of time and money and, you know, it's just all those things.
And by the way, I should also want to point out that a deload does not necessarily, and certainly in my case, does not mean cessation of training. It's reduced volume and reduced intensity of effort, where you're just not pushing yourself as hard. You're kind of just getting the muscles primed a little to foster recuperation for a week, so you basically just cut back on the volume for that week and don't push yourself quite as hard.
Okay, that's actually a great question. Can you clarify that for me, Brad? I have a lot of people who kind of vary on their opinion on what a deload should be. So now, should a deload be less volume but still pushing to maximum intensity, or should it be less volume and still not working as hard? So some guys suggest, well, you know, if you're normally doing 15 sets for a body part, do like 6 to 8, but still work just as hard, you know, still go as close to failure, or, you know, still just use the same amount of intensity, et cetera. Or some guys suggest, well, no, you shouldn't be working with as heavy a load and you shouldn't be going as close to failure.
Yeah, I tend to go for both, actually, to reduce. Now, again, it will depend on the person. There's not a right answer, but both volume and intensity are culprits in non-functional overreaching. So I tend to reduce the – so let's say someone's training 5 days a week. I'd cut back to 2 or 3 days a week for that deload, depending upon – now, for someone like yourself, a more advanced lifter, you can train a little more frequently, so the volume – and basically, by the way, frequency – I cut back volume by cutting back on frequency, not the volume within the workout itself. So I have them train a little less frequently, and I've found that actually is a better way to reduce the volume. Because it allows for better recuperation. If you're actually training, you're subjecting your body to a stress during that day. So anyway, I cut back on volume by reducing frequency by a day or two or three, depending upon how, again, various factors of the person, and certainly intensity of effort. So not pushing to failure, because it's been shown pretty clearly in the research that pushing to failure over and over and over again does suppress testosterone, increase cortisol, resting levels. And that's obviously not conducive to muscle growth. So it's a subjective, these are subjective, and that's one of the things that I always say, like in my book, that my Max Muscle Plan book, which was really the culmination of so many years, what I have hopefully put out there in this book is that it is a template, and that it has to be, I can't give you the, it's not like the keys to hypertrophy, I'm giving you the structure of what you can do, and then ultimately you have to get to know your body. It's not like just saying, okay, just do exactly what I say here and you're going to get jacked, because everyone responds differently, and you have to get in tune with your body and be able to manipulate the variables based upon your response.
Awesome. I know that's something I run into, Brad, is, you know, as a bodybuilder and someone who's maybe a little bit hard on myself for the most time, for the most part. Like, I want to get the most out of every workout. I run into this mental battle, I guess, with anytime I go in the gym, I try to create good habits. So, anytime I get into a set, I want to make sure that I'm taking that set. I mean, other than warm-up sets, when I really turn it on, I want to take that set to complete failure. So I used to battle with the idea of deloads and not working to failure, because I'm like, well, I'm going to create bad habits. And, you know, every time I go in the gym, I want to just go, like, all out and nothing else. So going in and doing a deload week, I used to struggle with, you know, backing off a little bit. And now in the last couple of years, I've obviously learned to do a little bit better. But I used to definitely struggle with that. It's like, you know, I'd go in and I would insist on – I would do less, but I would insist on still going to failure. And I thought, I mean, I didn't get the type of recovery I was looking for from the deload week, or I wouldn't get the type of results I was looking for. And now – I'm much more in tune with the deload, and I'm much more mentally able to go, it's okay. You know, you can do 60 or 70% of your intensity or of your effort and still get good results. Because, you know, obviously, as a young, aspiring bodybuilder, you just want to give it your all the time, because you think that's what everyone else out there is doing. And then you get, you know, you kind of get to what is, quote, unquote, the top of the sport. Not that I would say that I'm there yet, but you realize that there's not many people working that hard.
That's such a great point, Ben. And just to kind of expand on that, the mental aspect is so important that people don't get caught up in kind of this train hard at all mentality question. If I'm not, I'm shortchanging myself. And that's kind of where, when you kind of let your ego get in the way of what actually is going to get you your best results. And once you're able to separate that and say, look, I know that just because I think that, hey, I'm feeling this, doesn't necessarily mean it's going to work, so I don't necessarily need to do it. That's ultimately when you're going to maximize your own body, when you're able to put aside that the drive to just go by your immediate satisfaction to drive the mental aspect.
Yeah, I mean, as I'm sure you'll attest, I'm a big believer in habits being everything in life. So I used to be, you know, so eager to hold on to my habits of, I only work hard when I go in the gym. I didn't want to create any negative habits. It was hard to unbreak that, or it was hard to break that habit. You know, it's hard to unlearn that habit. So hopefully I'm a little bit stronger mentally now than I was when I first turned pro. And I think I'm progressing even better now that I'm learning to appreciate those days off and even those weeks off.
Well, to accomplish what you have in such a short period of time really speaks to your approach. It's just so impressive to someone like myself that mean, placing second in the Arnold after basically a few years of competition really is pretty amazing.
And I really feel like I've only scratched the surface, and which is why I'm looking to people like yourself and Mr. Meadows for, you know, the best advice and you know, whatever quote-unquote optimal is. It's always that quest, you know, because I really believe that I've only started to scratch the surface, and I'm sure John's thinking the same way. Is, you know, as much as we've been training for a long time, you know, every day you learn something new, and you're like, man, I'm only just starting to scratch the surface of what's possible with my physique. So, you know, that's why bodybuilding is such an exciting endeavor. It just never ends. So, John, any questions from you, man?
Well, I can't think of any, but Brad, it's always awesome, mate, to hear your, you know, what your the latest thing that you're doing and to get your perspective on things. So, man, I just appreciate you taking the time to talk with us. As, you know, you have a huge effect on a lot of people out there. You have a lot of influence, and we need more people like you in the industry. And, you know, when people ask me questions that I think are pretty deeply rooted in science, the first thing I do is I tell them to look up your paper, The Mechanisms of Muscle Hypertrophy, which I think that's when you wrote a couple of years ago. That's the first place I send people. So just keep up the good work and know that there's a lot of us out here that are really influenced by what you're doing.
Well, thank you so much, guys. As I said before, I have total respect for both of you. So really the feeling is mutual.
Brad, just before we go, can you give people, not everyone wants to dive into your research papers, but a lot of people would be willing to pick up your book and read what you have to say. So can you give people your site and just like a 30-second synopsis of your book? If that's possible.
Yeah, the website is lookgreatnaked.com. By the way, you don't want to use lookgoodnaked because I hear that's a porn site. So it is lookgreatnaked.com.
Great.
And the book is The Max Muscle Plan. Really, it's the culmination of my 20-plus years of practical experience as well as now over a dozen years in the research trenches. And it basically gives a entire blueprint for optimizing your hypertrophic potential, your muscle building potential, and it's done in layman's terms, has 6 months worth of routines in a periodized fashion, and really delves into the art of hypertrophy as well as backed by science, but teaching someone how to get the most out of their own genetics.
Yeah, I've read the book. I thought it was excellent. Obviously, a great resource for me and something I still look to when I'm designing programs, whether it be for myself or for clients. So, Brad, you're awesome, man. Keep doing what you do and know that everybody appreciates what you do. And we're going to, like John and I are doing right now, we're going to do our best to promote you so the world knows, you know, where this great information is coming from.
Thanks so much, guys. Hopefully we can do this again.
Definitely. I'm sure we will, Brad. Thanks so much. And okay. Have a great day.
You too, guys.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Stay connected on Facebook / IFBB Ben PAK fan page, on Twitter at IFBB Ben PAK, and of course, BenPakulski.com.